City Council Meeting Workshop, Monday, May 4th, 2015, 7:00 PM.
First of all, could you stand? Give a short invocation, followed by a prayer of allegiance.
Father God, we thank you for this wonderful day that you've given us today, and we thank you for the many blessings that you have bestowed upon the city, and we ask that you continue to do so. We ask that you be with us here tonight in our decision-making, and that we can make the best decisions for the city and help further it. We pray this in your name. Amen.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Roll call. All council members are present tonight. Citizens input. This is time for citizens input. If anybody would like to address the council at this time, I allow 5 minutes for each individual. Seeing no citizen input, we will continue to 2.1, Animal Ordinance Discussion. Heather.
Good evening, council members. So, growing community and population, with our dog ordinances, some of the issues we've come up with need to probably be changed just a little bit for better enforcement and to better reflect a little bit for the RCWs. Couple of them that are in there say the dangerous dog. It actually says it has to bite twice within a year, and so some of these dogs that are coming out here and doing some pretty big bites technically don't qualify. So to kind of just change that a little bit to get some better enforcement towards that, we would kind of like to go forward with that on the dog ordinance if that works.
So what does the RCW say on it?
It talks about the severity of the bites. So it differentiates between a dog that kills another dog or livestock type of thing versus humans, and there's physical injury, impairment of physical condition or substantial pain versus serious physical injury, any physical injury that creates a substantial risk of death or causes permanent loss, bodily organ or function, or disfigurement. So it just kind of is more specific with things versus, oh, your dog bit somebody.
Okay. So we need to bring our ordinance up to par with the RCW.
Right. Yeah, because if, you know, you have a little chihuahua that bites a kid on the finger and they get a Band-Aid, you know, legally it still has to be reported and you still have to make sure there's the rabies and stuff like that. So it's not really going to be a big dangerous dog. But then when you get into the German Shepherds or Boxers that are out there, you know, killing other small animals and things, we need to make sure we're classifying them properly. And then the conditions of release. So per our OMC right now, we don't have, again, specifics on it versus the RCWs. So we want to add, you know, the six-sided kennel possibility of wearing a dangerous dog tag. So if it gets loose off of a property, people know that that is a dangerous dog and to stay away from it. Or the officers know that this dog in the past has attacked or killed or something of that nature. So just little things like that that we'd like to add, and I'll get it all put together. And then you guys could go over it once we get to that point. And
let me add to that a little bit. We actually had an experience with a dangerous dog just a few months ago. But one of the things that we found as we're researching it is if a dog is designated as a dangerous dog and it bites someone again after they've been cited, it's actually a felony. So it's a fairly significant event. One of the things that we should be moving towards, anytime we have a dog that hurts someone, we should be moving to have that dog destroyed. and so that some of the options that can be built into an ordinance. And so that's what we're looking for, is feedback from council to know what council would like to see in an ordinance. One of the recommendations that Heather's recommending is that we actually create a graduated set type system where, you know, if a dog barks at somebody, that's one level, but if it barks and lunges, that might take it to another level. If it barks, lunges, and, you know, bites them, that's, so it takes it up to different levels of classification. So we're looking from council input on what you would like to see in a dog ordinance, but there was also some consideration for fees, where we're charging currently every year for a dog license. If we did, and realistically, we're not making money on dog licenses. It's a matter that we want them licensed so that we can match dogs up to people when they run away. So the fee is not an issue for us, but what we're running into is every January, we have how many licenses we issue?
Roughly 500.
That's quite a lot. If we staggered it, did it every 3 years, so that a license was good for 3 years and they paid slightly more money, that would actually reduce our work quite a bit at the PD.
Or for senior citizens, a $5 per life, one for their dog, was suggested in there also. Other cities surrounding have that one, and the senior citizens really like that one, so.
Okay, any more on that one? I know Heather's got several others she wants to discuss. So you're going to bring us some proposed ordinance changes,
mm-hmm,
and bring them back,
yep,
at a future council meeting,
yep,
for us to review.
Yep.
Okay.
Okay.
Is that gonna go to compliance committee, or is that gonna come directly back here?
Directly back to you guys, unless you want to discuss it. I mean, it's pretty much as she laid it out.
Okay.
And we'll get that done. We'll get that done enough time to get that to you to ask questions of myself or Heather or the chief beforehand.
Okay, once we get that done, is that going to be run by Kelly?
Oh, we'll run the ordinance by Kelly, yes.
Okay.
Of course. Yep. Run all of them back.
All in favor?
So the next one, some community input and questions, having a few laying hens in town. Of course, no roosters. So started researching that, looking at other cities that are the going green, you know, having a few little chickens in your backyard to eat the bugs and lay your eggs. I found some where, of course, they're again not trying to add workload to us, but allowing the citizens to have it. They'd have to come in and do an application, which it wouldn't cost them anything. They would just do a drawing on, this is where it's located in my yard. And so if people start calling saying there's chickens, my neighbor's yard, we already have on file that, yep, it's approved in that location. They do a little drawing. Of course, we wouldn't want them right up against the neighbor's property or too close to their house. So there would be conditions on how far away from the properties, things like that. And, you know, we did, looking at some of them, you know, you can do, might not pass these up here. There's such simple little designs that people could have. And then rabbits were also questioned. The way our ordinance has read in the past with the exotic animals and the farm animals, back in the 50s when that ordinance was made, being a little more rural, people had all that stuff in their backyards. Now, you know, people have pet rabbits and they house train them because rabbits can be potty trained. And so, you know, people always question, why can't we have a pet rabbit or just a couple chickens? So we thought we'd, you know, look into that ordinance and see if we could go somewhere with that in our city.
Personally, I don't have any problem with rabbits, but laying hens are noisy. And, you know, even though they don't have the rooster that's crowing, when they're laying, they are noisy and they stink. Sorry.
There's a provision for it. It would have to be kept sanitary. And so, like, if the neighbors start complaining that there's a smell, of course, I knock on the door and they show me your coop. And if it's dirty, you get your infraction because they have to keep it clean.
Would they have to apply for some sort of license to have a...
They would have to fill out an application that would not cost them anything, but they would just draw us a picture of where it would be on their property, and it would be on file, so we would be aware of what they had.
Let me say, that is all up to council. Whether we move forward, right now chickens are illegal in city limits. So we're putting this in front as a discussion item. Whether or not we have chickens, then how, if so, how many? If so, and how many is answered, then is there a license fee? That's up to you guys. If you want them licensed, that's up to council. Our recommendation is we don't want to go do inspections because that's more workload, significantly. But if they, if council were to approve something like this, we would want to work into the ordinance that if there's noise complaints, they have to be resolved. If there's smell or smell issues, if there's people complaining that they're unhealthy, then those would be violations that would have to be built in. But if council doesn't want us to even move forward that much, then those are all moved.
I see that more of a making y'all's life real busy. Real busy if that, that goes through. Mm-hmm. With them, like Gina said, getting out, flying into the neighbor's yard.
Getting
then the neighbor's dog eats it.
In the middle of the night, they start squawking. Yeah. I have enough problems with the dogs barking in the neighborhood. I don't need to hear chickens in the middle of the night. Like I said, I have no problem with rabbits as long as they're not raising them for meat. If it was a pet rabbit, and one or two, but I don't have any problem with that because they don't really make that much noise unless they're really disturbed.
The cities that, like Spokane, Seattle, that a lot of the cities are starting to do this, and they don't seem to be having any of those issues. Granted, that's how they have their set up, things like that.
I know the city of Spokane is probably one of the newest, larger cities to allow this, and they did it in the last couple of years. Mm-hmm. This is going on already.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Oh, yes.
Many, many places. And you could hear them in the mornings.
Uh-huh.
And there's a lot of chickens in backyards around this town.
Got rid of quite a few out of town. So, and some people are very adamant about, these are my chickens and I want them. I'm like, then out they go. And they will. They'll pack them up and they'll take them out.
Ellensburg, you can have, I think it's 3 laying hens. My mother-in-law, she had them.
So how do you guarantee there's only 3 in a coop?
It would have to be complaint driven. The neighbors would have to call and say, I'm hearing a whole lot of noise over there. Just like with the dogs in the town, some people have more than the 3 dogs and they just keep them in their house. And unless we get a call there or something, we don't know that they're there.
Personally, myself, I have no problem with it. The only thing, I don't see a need to license them, but just voluntary compliance to let us know the residents where they're at.
Right. That's why the cities kind of did the application. A lot of the cities that I've looked at, they have an application fee and they have a inspection fee. Reducing all of that for us, we were thinking just have the application so that way they are complying. They're coming in, they're saying, hey, I want them. I'm going to have them. Where's my paperwork? And thank you very much. So kind of simplified it for Othello if that would work.
So what direction would council, I think I saw 2 no's, I think maybe 2 I don't cares. Should we continue with this?
Draft something up so we can see what.
So that's 3 okay with, probably okay, bring something forward for a vote.
Just a ordinance for review.
In that discussion, one of the things that we saw with other cities was a setback from neighbors. 25 foot seems to be fairly normal. So we present that. 3 hens, no roosters. has to be cleaned, it actually spells out what the space of the coop is. Is there other kind of conditions that council would like to see written into that ordinance?
Well, something in dealing with the waste generated. I'm sure that there's probably something in some ordinance somewhere for that.
Okay.
And also the penalty phases of that too need to be addressed.
The what?
Penalty phases.
Okay.
So that leads us to the next question. If there is a penalty to a violation, what range would council like to see so we can say whether it's C5, 6, 7, 125-ish, 150, 200? What are you thinking?
Any comment from the council on that?
I think I don't know what would be high enough to make sure, you know, you want to set it high enough that it prevents them doing, just going back and doing it again, and then saying, oh, well, if I get caught, I'll just pay the fee again. I don't know, what, we have other ordinances that already have some sets, some levels in there, so maybe look and see what we have the other set at.
Unfortunately, a lot of our ordinances leave too much discretion, and that's what we're trying to fix as we move forward. Well, I don't want, like, I think our dog ordinance or some of the others where it says 25 to 200. I want to say it's $160 or it's, you know, so we set it at C5, C8, whatever that turns out to be. You want us to shoot towards 100 or shoot towards 200?
I'd say put it in between.
Yeah.
Any other thoughts or ideas on it?
Nope.
Okay.
Okay.
So then our next one is with our feral cat population in town. We're starting to have some civil cases amongst neighbors that are going to court and restraining orders. People are complaining about their properties being ruined, things like that, because of the mass amount of feral cats. I know there are several feeding stations in town where people actually come in and feed them. I'm not sure if it's daily, weekly, or how it is, but I know it's a consistent basis in several spots. Of course, starting to do research on the feral cat populations. You know, there's research that says, you know, you can't just stop feeding them because it's inhumane. But if you keep feeding them, the disease that they're spreading. So I guess, council, we're asking kind of if you have any thoughts on what to do about our feral population. Should we stop feeding them completely and make it illegal? Do we let it continue? One ordinance I found, it was actually back east, and actually there were a few of them back there. There's a feral cat giver permit. Again, some of them charge, more controversy amongst that. But the feral cat giver would have to tediously work towards trapping and neutering in what they call ear tipping. So basically when the vet has the animal under for the spay or neuter, that cutting of the ear would identify them once they're re-released, so you know that cat has been fixed.
That you're saying you would capture a cat, a feral cat, and neuter it, and then release it again?
Mm-hmm. So that would be
into the city?
Yes. Expense to the city?
No, to the caregiver that chooses. So the way I've looked at the research is the city makes it illegal to feed the cats. So if you're caught feeding the feral cats, you're going to get in trouble. But if you come forward and you say, you know what, I want to be responsible for these cats. So instead of just feeding them, now you're providing medical care and reducing the population of the cat. You know, the cats breed. One female can have about 3 litters a year. So if there's a food source, they're going to keep populating and our problem's going to get larger. So, you know, they're again with the not feeding them, they're going to start dying off, which wouldn't be great. The caregiver permit would allow citizens who wanted to take the responsibility to come forward and do that. And there are a lot of organizations out there willing to come in. When I went to that conference in New Orleans, there's Alley Cat Alleys. I mean, there's several that says, contact us and we can come do a spay-neuter program. They're here for a week. They help traffic the stations. They spay and neuter in large amounts. So there's resources out there for people to do this. If the city to do that, that would be such a huge product. So allowing the citizens to step forward and do that and then having them use those resources is an option. So
I just want to be clear. My assumption of a feral cat is a wild cat.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It's got no owner. It's living.
It's not friendly. It won't let you touch it. It won't come near you. But if you put food out in an alley, it's going to slink over and eat it.
But for whatever, however you plan to capture these things or get a hold of them, once you have them, you wouldn't release them back. You would. Mm-hmm. Why?
If we had a feral cat program that put the cost on the people that like to feed them, the people that like to feed the feral cats are the ones that are creating this population boom.
Yes.
So if they're going to continue to feed them, it's reasonable, we believe it's reasonable that they also pay to fix them. And if they're going to put them back out, we'll put them out as fixed cats, the population can start to go down some.
Right.
The issue, one of the concerns that Heather and I have discussed in my experience, cats can only be trapped once. Once we trap them, they're smart enough, they will not go in that trap again. We will get one shot per cat. So this kind of thing, what we're noticing is, I mean, there's quite a few, and I mean, I think we talked in the hundreds of feral cats running around town right now, and that's just what we can find. They come out at night. We in no way want to put the expense of cats on the city. And another thing that I want to put out real clear to council is please don't want to license cats.
No.
Half the community, probably half the community lets their cat out at night.
Exactly.
That's half of them that you're seeing is the cane cat running around too.
I've got neighbors that their cats are just outside all the time and they're breeding and they're all over the place.
Either way, we believe we need to put an ordinance in front of council, because what I don't find in our ordinance is the authority for us to actually pick up and destroy feral cats. So when we know council's direction and you know, what some of your input is, we can put together the ordinance, but it needs to give us the authority to pick them up. And then as we're doing that, if council wants to continue allowing people to feed feral cats at cat stations, then we need to create something to start curbing that population, which would mean we put the expense on them to pay to fix them. And that's our recommendation to council, if that's the direction we want to go. The other option is just much simpler, and that's that it's illegal to feed feral cats. What I saw that other cities are doing is they actually set hours that people can feed their cats outside, that they can't leave food outside all night. In my experience, that also helps reduce skunks and porcupines and some other types of animals that we generally don't want in the city.
Research shows that if you just trap and remove them, more will come in. So studies by these organizations over the many, many years and throughout the different countries of the world, it's never been successful to just remove them. They always come back. So that's why we lean towards more recommending some sort of a trap and neuter release program versus just trying to rid of them, because we don't feel, looking at the studies and everything, that they would go away.
I just don't see how in the town where we've got a pretty low income community that there's going to be people willing to pay to neuter all these animals.
Well, that's where the organizations would come into play in that sense. Like I said, there were at least three at the conference in New Orleans.
Which conference was this?
The Humane Society of the United States put on one expo a year, and there were, I believe, 2,400 attendees from around the world this year. And knowing we had the feral cat problem, I made a point to go talk to some of them, saying, what's your best thing to do? And, some of them are a little extreme in their ways of thinking, but when you start looking at the whole, statistically, they just don't go away. With that being said, trying to have some sort of a plan on how to take care of them at the feeding stations, get them medical, get these organizations in here to help us.
What kind of cost is it to have those companies come in and do that?
They, I believe they do it for free. That, I didn't get into that with them because I just started doing the research on how our city would even go forward with something like this. And short of putting the project on the city, you know, either just making it illegal to feed them, allowing a caregiver permit where that caregiver could contact these organizations that are willing to do this. So, you know, of course, more information is needed. But I know they travel all around.
We are not recommending to council contracting with the program to deal with cats that cost money. If there's a volunteer type company that wants to, or organization that wants to come in and fix cats that doesn't cost us money, that's something I could support, but I could not support recommending to council something that's going to cost us money. The issue that we have right now is the population is going to continue to increase as the food continues to go. And I'm just going to say, there's some very good, kind people feeding these cats. So this
has... Have you identified, you know, particular feeding stations? Mm-hmm. Have we tried public education with the people to let them know what kind of a problem it's been causing?
A couple of the stations, the people did start trapping and neutering them and re-releasing them. I haven't taken a lot of time for follow-ups and studies on those. To see how they were working in those areas, but I know they were doing that as of a year ago. And that one was behind kickstands because there were a lot of complaints from that area. And so they started doing that in that neighborhood.
I think that's where it kind of came to a head where we actually had an assault and a restraining order, and I mean, it's all about these cats.
So. One feeding station is near a tire store. And so then the cats lay or go in the tires and have their kittens. And so then not only is there cat feces back in the tire areas, but then there's kittens that back there. And one call I got, they said, you know, there's these dead kittens back here. We don't know what to do. So I went to pick up the kitten and it was alive. And it was so sick. Cats get upper respiratory, and at 2 to 3 weeks old, this kitten's eye was pressing out and stuff. It was just so diseased. So took it into the vet and had it humanely euthanized at that point. They thought it was dead. So the businesses are having these problems.
So what would council like to see in an ordinance coming forward?
Well, I definitely would not like to just quit feeding them and have them starve to death.
Okay.
I'm not really, you know, you would have to find the right areas to have feeding stations. You cannot have them near businesses and things going on like that. But even at that, if you're feeding them near residences, then you're going to end up with residences with their flower beds and everything else full of cat feces. And I know it happens in mine, and it makes me very upset. So
if we were to put an ordinance that actually prevented the feeding stations, but allowed a grace period where they could taper it off, that might help with some of the starvation issues.
I know I wouldn't be very happy if somebody was feeding next to my house.
So if you're going to taper it off, then are you going to, or are we going to have it in the ordinance that they're going to be trapped and euthanized, or because
eventually we're going to have to be there. You know, when we have, you know, hundreds if not thousands of cats, we need an ordinance that allows us to trap and euthanize. Mm-hmm. And we're talking to our cats. I mean, we get some big fat tabby kind of cat, and it's obviously some big cat. That is not the cat we're talking about, but also it's difficult for us to match that cat up to somebody because we don't license
cats.
But what I, you know, if we were to say that the feeding stations were not to continue, but we said as of a certain date, that gives some time to taper it off. Eventually, we're going to have to do some, you know, if we can find some organization to cap, you know, to trap them, neuter them, and, you know, put it here, then we could actually start reducing the population through know, attrition that way. But as it is, I mean, there's nothing slowing this down.
I know Adams County Pet Rescue's got their hands full with the dogs issue stuff, but I know they still work with cats. Is this something that they would work along with us?
Yes, that's the new contract we specified in there, that they would take the other animals, specifically talks of the cats were thrown into that. They've actually already started transferring cats to other organizations that have come in, again, because the community is to that point where members are starting to take action, and I think on a weekly basis about their transferring cats out. I know yesterday two litters of kittens and one mama cat were transferred out, so 12 cats left yesterday to a transfer. I think the week before there were 5 of them, so that they're able to get them to home.
So when they're being transferred, where are they transferred to?
These ones yesterday went down to Oregon with the Animal House gals that were here. They have resources there. Normally we go to Kitsap County, and occasionally Grant County will take some.
Then you're not talking about feral cats?
Not talking feral.
These are just found cats?
Yes.
And I mean, there's two different...
Or kittens.
Yeah, there's two different types, and feral is wild.
Mm-hmm.
They're not going to come near humans and...
Right. Feral cat versus domestic cat, coyote versus dog. I mean,
right.
That's kind of what you're looking at.
Yeah, so I think you need to, personally, in my opinion, as a councilman, draft some, something stronger for the feral cat population, the elimination of it as much as possible. Now, if you say it's going to continue to replenish itself, then it's going to be an ongoing issue. But wild cats carry diseases, and they're going to hurt other people's pet cats.
Which we've had that also.
Yeah,
we've
when you get a wild
cases of that.
When you get a wild tomcat that.
I had one cat that was actually breaking into the lady's garage, and she had almost $1,000 in medical bills to save one of the cats that was in the garage because it's feral tom, and I ended up loaning her a trap, and she tried to trap it, but I think it got smart, but it went away after it figured out there was a trap there, so she didn't have the problems anymore.
So that's my opinion. That's what I'd like to see, is something a little stronger to deal with the wild feral cats.
Okay.
To protect them.
Would council also like to put a limit on how many, like we do with dogs, a limit on how many cats a person can have in their property or house?
There should be.
So 3 cats, 4 cats, do you have a number?
To me, I don't want to see that. That's my personal opinion. But
yeah, because
we can leave that out.
There could be, a cat could have kittens, and there could be at one time more than 3 or 4. And
most of the ordinances, including the dog ordinance, allow, a certain amount, unless they're under a certain age.
Mm-hmm.
That gives the well-being time to actually get them farmed out.
I personally, I wouldn't mind seeing, because I know that there's people in our neighborhood that have a multitude of cats. And it's, we're limited to how many dogs we can have. I think that it's, especially when they're allowed to run free, it would be nice to limit the number of cats that are running around out there, but that's my favorite opinion.
Any other council members got any input on that?
Thanks. And again, it would be complaint.
I'd say 3.
It'd be complaint driven, so we wouldn't. Door to door asking.
No.
You'd have to kind of lock it into nuisance complaints or whatever.
It's the horror story type situations where we're going to get involved, where we show up and there's 30, 40 cats in the house and they're dumping food on the ground. They stop taking care of the litter. Those are the ones that get really ugly for us. But, somehow there's got to be those cases would just start, taking them because it's unhealthy. So was there a number that I didn't hear the number?
I'd say 3 or 4.
Okay. We can put that together and the council can modify as we go. Do you want to talk to Ms. Alex?
We've also kind of done a little research on exotics, alligators, poisonous frogs, making snakes, so that you have your venomous snakes and your non-venomous snakes, and then you have your venomous snakes that have had the venom removed. So basically, I would recommend if it's a venomous snake, even if it says it's venomous or no, not having that, would council be interested in the ordinance?
To be more specific, our current ordinance says that anything other than a cat or a dog is prohibited. So many people have rabbits, many people have, I mean, I can't imagine having a pig in my house, but things like hamsters, gerbils, small snakes.
Guinea pigs.
Guinea pigs, iguanas, and there's other types of pets that I think are fairly reasonable pets for some people. I will not recommend any kind of venomous animal or, something that can harm anybody, and I think those should be prohibited. But would council like to see us modify the ordinance that would allow people to actually have the hamsters, gerbils, stuff like that they already have without it being illegal?
Probably want to put birds in there also.
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, and we'll go on to 2.02, consideration of East Main Street, 6-inch horse mane. Terry?
I need to leave or just not vote?
Good evening, Mayor and Council.
Not vote.
Back on March 9th, we awarded a bid for approximately 4,400 feet of 6-inch horse mane on Cunningham Road here to POW Contracting. Shortly after that, legal had contacted us and wanted us to break out and finish up that portion of the sewer that Pegram Construction was working on with the water main. About 3.5-4 weeks went by before we got that handled, and we sent out a notice to proceed. There was a contract signed by POW Contracting for that force main. We sent the notice to proceed out. In the process of that 3.5-4 weeks of getting that other broke out, they've demobed and sent some of their guys to other projects and moved their equipment off site. So they've asked our legal, through their legal, to breach the contract with the city because of these situations they have, and no longer do the work. And so we met with the Water and Sewer Committee and asked the Water and Sewer Committee what they wanted to do. And we have options of going to the second lowest bidder and offering that award to them. And that's what we did. That's what they suggested that we do. So we went back and we took the second lowest bidder, which was Pegram Construction, for $144,431.09, and asked him if he would do the job for his bid price. He agreed, and we're here at council tonight to ask council to approve that award to Pegram Construction for that amount.
So we're going to do a motion at the workshop?
I was going to bring it up in a little bit. Normally we do not take a vote on a workshop, but RCW and the Ophelia OMC does allow us to if we do need to under certain circumstances, and this needs to be done. So when they talked to me Friday about this, I told them I was okay to bring it up to the council for a vote tonight so we can get this project finished and get Main Street working again.
Yeah, they want to start Wednesday locates, and Wednesday's when they'd like to proceed.
Okay, I know Pegram was our next lowest bidder. They were out there on the water project. Is a lot of their equipment still out there?
All of it.
Okay, the thing I noticed is there was a $15,000 mobilization on that. Could that be worked with on that since they are still on the
Where do you want to go ahead?
Site? Yeah. Or is that?
One thing we looked at, because John brought up the bid laws, so I started researching bid laws. It turns out once you award a bid, you can't negotiate with the bidder. At that point, you're done. And so, or during the bid process, you can't. The bid is what it is. So, if you dig deeper, perhaps there's something you can do. And I'll look at it again, but I don't think you can go back and renegotiate that bid, so to speak. Accept it as is, or not accept it. So, he gives us the bid, we say, okay, accept it.
What, the $144,000 was still under the engineer's estimate?
It was under, how much, Carrie, remember?
I don't recall exactly how far down that is, but...
Yeah, I can't...
I think the engineer was $215,000.
I think you're right, $215,000 or $217,000 or something like that, Corey, I believe. So it was well below.
It was $215,000, $215,400.
That's what it was, yeah.
So our feeling, I believe on the committee, was that it was better to go with the second lowest bidder. And it's bonus that he's a local contractor. And it's still a very low bid compared to the estimate, so that's...
And for the rest of the council, we laid out several options. One was to just call it off and wait till later on. But then we've already got them out there. We take the chance that the bid may go higher, for one. For two, if we wait till wintertime, early spring of next year, the ground's sloppy, it's a mess. I'm sure Mark will testify to that. And it becomes more of a problem and maybe more expensive. But so we could do that. We could try and hold POW to a contract. And then we, you know, go through the legal thing. And Kelly advised that we would spend as much money probably trying to go through the legal hoops, trying to get them to do a contract, as it would the difference in...
For the difference in the contract.
Yeah, and of course, as Judy just said, that we had the added bonus, we have a local, you know, contractor that is there ready to do the job. And the other piece, we believe, is that the person who owns the corner gas station out there wants to build a hotel motel and is waiting on sewer to be there, so it's there, and he'll be ready to, we don't know when he'll be ready to build, but he's maybe put him in more of a better position to do it.
Okay. Any other comments or questions for Terry at this time? Do we have a motion to award the contract to Pegram Construction?
I'll make that motion.
We got a first?
Second.
Second?
I'll excuse myself from voting tonight.
Okay. All in favor of the motion, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion so carried. 2.03, verbal de-escalating training. Debbie?
I gave you some information in board docs relevant to some training opportunities that are coming up. We looked at different training for communicating with people who may be upset about city codes, policies, or decisions that have been made, and how our employees can respond to those situations. And so WCIA has a training session titled Verbal De-escalation, and it really fits our need here at City Hall, in the Police Department, and with Public Works. We are conducting 2 4-hour training sessions on Friday, May 15th in the Police Department training room. One is in the morning from 8 to 12. The other one is from 1 to 5. And if any of the elected officials would want to attend that, if you can just get a hold of me, and I'll put you on our list. And we can accommodate maybe around 16 people, employees, elected officials in the training room. So if you are interested, there is some money in the budget for education and conferences. There's approximately $800 for our elected officials right now. Just get a hold of me if you'd like to attend.
Okay, are both sessions exactly the same, so it's one or the other?
Yes, they're okay. Exactly the same. It's Friday the 15th.
Thank you.
Okay. On the 2.04, Adams County Fire District 5 report. Gary.
Good evening. Thank you for the opportunity. Last week, Wade asked me to come and talk about the workshop that we had. The workshop, my board wanted to meet with the council members that sit on the, if you will, fire council, and talk about the city of Othello's growth and the growth of the fire department. Okay. The first topic of the evening that night, we talked about the surveying rating, Washington State or Washington Surveying Rating Bureau. It's an agency, nonprofit agency, that rates fire departments around the state. They also rate other operations, but this particular was our fire department. We were rated in 2012. We were rated a classification of a 5. We're a stronger 5 than we were before, but we're still not where I would be comfortable. I'd like to improve. And we strive to do that all the time, to improve our services, offer more to the community as well. The Rating Bureau has changed their matrix now. So the next time they rate us, we will be on a different matrix. The matrix is not something that the general knowledge or general person could look at and calculate what our classification is. There's a lot of, in our eyes, interpretation to the matrix. So we want to be proactive and not reactive. We would like to start building for the future, growing for the future, and establishing some programs that will ensure that we stay a 5 and improve our rating. To go to a classification of 4 without full-time crews around the block may be difficult. I wouldn't say it was impossible, but we want to improve our classification, secure it. The result of jumping a classification, going to a 6 protection class, would be a increase in insurance policies. A commercial policy, a commercial business would see an increase roughly 23% to 25% in their annual fees. Residential would be roughly a 15% increase. And those figures were calculated a little over a year ago, but it makes a big difference if you look at the community as a whole. We've got a lot of business that would feel that burden. We've got a lot of residents that would feel that burden as well. So we would like to provide service to the community and secure it with some programs that we've identified, as well as others that we hope to that will benefit the community in the future. So if you could move one more page, please.
Oh, really slow.
Spencer, are you talking to me? Sorry. Just over to the first column on the left. We'll start there. With the help of Kelly McGrew from Surveying and Rating, we went through and identified a start of programs that we can implement and start working towards a more secure 5 classification. The first column are things that we can do now with current staff and current budget. The first being an annual road testing of apparatus, includes documentation. And Surveying Rating is very specific on how they want it documented. That's something we currently do. We do the road testing. We just haven't been documenting it in the fashion that they want to see it. So we've changed that already. The second is a nozzle test annually, which we will implement this summer. Every nozzle in the fleet will have to be taken off, tested. It can be tested in-house, just identify any problems, which we don't anticipate, but we will do that this summer. The another thing they suggest are station generators. We are in the process of upgrading our roof station with a generator. Our main station here on Broadway was done 2 years ago after the September windstorm that came through. That generator we had at that time failed. So we've upgraded and now have our entire station is powered off the generator here, and it will be at Bruce too shortly. So weight verification of apparatus, we do that, but now we have to do it annually. Weight verification is we're weighing each axle, overall weight, and then side differential as well. We have to document that. And we have a rolling stock of little, well, 24 right now that have to be done. So it takes some time to do, but we'll get that accomplished this summer. We're increasing our officer training. We've started a training program now that we're out doing some walkthrough tours of structures, businesses, industry, and we'll be doing that throughout the year, just implementing that to get more familiar with the businesses, give us more training hours. Another option that they talked about was training with our mutual aid partners. Our mutual aid partners are our local fire districts, fire departments around us that we have agreements with. If we have a event here in Othello that we need assistance with, we can request them to come in and they will do so. It's a return that we give them as well. Doing doing the training with our mutual aid partners just lets each one of us know that we can rely on and what level of service we're going to get from each other. This will need to be developed. We'll need to set some topics of training, and it takes buy-in from our partners, which I do feel that we can get, and I'll go into that on another item. Number seven would be our live fire training. We do this every other year. We need to move it to every year. 6 to 8 hours of live fire training, which is above the LNI requirement of every 3 years. Now, Washington Survey or Washington Survey and Rating Bureau wants it annually. So we can accomplish that. It will take an increase in our budget, but we can do that in-house and accomplish that. That is where I would like to get our mutual aid partners to buy in, come in, and take advantage of our live fire training. We bring the wall-to-wall flashover trailer up. They've got several props within the trailer. Also, they've got a live burn inside the trailer that we can actually go into and fight the fire. They control it, and it's relatively safe. It's something that we can't do here locally yet, but we're going to take advantage of that. That will probably happen in the 2016 budget year. Ladder testing. They want to see our ladders, our ground ladders, tested annually, which is not a problem. It's just an expense that we will occur. Along with that testing comes the repair or replacement. It is a very aggressive test. They load them, they center load them, they tip load them, and we're liable to lose a few ladders through this testing annually. So there will be a cost there of replacement, repair, or length of replacement.
And my understanding too, during the ladder testing, it also decreases the lifespan of the ladder too because of the test they're putting on it?
Well, it is such an aggressive test that you're probably looking at a decrease of ladder life, yes. Increased training requirements. We're looking at options throughout our training activities to see what method we can use now. We're looking at online trainings, we're looking at computer-based trainings, different methods to keep our volunteers more up to date and increase our hours of training. Currently, they require 20 hours of training a month of volunteers, which is extremely difficult. Our volunteers, all of our volunteers work full-time jobs. They have families. And just like all of you on council, it would be very difficult to find 20 hours a month. So we want to explore other options to get closer to that. We probably won't hit the 20 hours, but we want to get closer to it. And something I didn't mention at the beginning, survey and rating has one matrix. That matrix is good for the city of Seattle, city of Spokane, city of Othello as well. We're graded against all the bigger departments, and all the smaller communities than us are graded the same way too. So there aren't volunteer matrices versus full paid staff matrices either.
Do your people get a time on the hose? I mean, when you respond to a fire and stuff, I mean, doesn't that count for something for you?
On the job training?
Yeah.
We can count some of those hours. It's a process that we go through, but we still can't quite get the 20 hours. You know, there might be a few months a year that we could, but survey and rating wants it to be a structured protection or structured suppression event. We do wildland, we do rescue, we do our hazmat, we do the full gamut. A lot of those things don't count towards that training.
Wow.
So, yeah. And additional portable radios and spares for scene communication. We're in the process of upgrading some of our radios now. That is just going to be a yearly process, and we'll probably start in 2016 with a little more aggressive look at that. Number 12 would be reduce hose inventory to a manageable amount. Right now we have, it's close to 20,000 feet of hose. We have a huge number, and we would like to get it down to a manageable amount to where we can test the hose all in one year. Right now, we're doing it about doing the complete rotation of hose every 3 years, which that took a hit for us on our audit that they did. So we would like to get to a one-year testing, annual testing of all our hose, a 15-year life cycle of hose. So we're turning our hose inventory every 15 years. We're annually testing, which we normally don't burst hose. We don't find failures in our hose. So I don't expect to have a lot of failure that we have to recoup any cost on there. But the 15-year rotation is going to be a budget item that we will have to address. The reduction of inventory, I think there are ways to accomplish this program that will be beneficial to the city and the county if we can share some hose there. The county will have to do some upgrading, and the city will have to be willing to, you know, share just a joint pool of reserve. That way the city doesn't have to have a reserve. We don't have to have a full reserve. We can share that. And that is a operational function that we can accomplish that. the next item, sleepers. We've looked at this in the past. Sleepers are firefighters that sleep at the station at night. They might work their day job, they might work a night job and sleep during the day at the station. They're there to respond to alarms. They're not necessarily full-paid firefighters. They're the volunteer people that want to come in and pull a shift. They're there for 10 to 12 hours, and it just helps our numbers when we respond. We'll increase response time and the number of firefighters we have on site. The note there takes buy-in from the volunteers. The volunteers have to be on board with this because it's dependent on them. They have to be happy with it. We have to design a program that will work with them. And right now, we haven't even started on that. But that is a, without them, we can't do it. So it has to work for them. It will take some station upgrades. We've done a few, but it will take some more station upgrades to be able to house people in the station, let them sleep comfortably in a location where they can rest.
What weight does that have with improving your rating?
The more, reduce our response time, we'll have more people there, and if we have a manned station, we get credit for that.
Okay. So. How much would, what's a break-off point to decrease our rating to like a 4 for number of people, full-time employees?
In the past, they've told us that we need full-time employees, and you're looking at probably 12 firefighters.
12 full-time firefighters?
To run a crew of 3.
Okay, and you have 6 now?
We have 3.
3?
Including myself.
3 full-time firefighters? So that'd be an increase of 9 total.
Roughly, yes. And that's per minimum. Additional fire inspector training hours. We're currently looking for that. Normally we can fund some training around the state. This year it seems like it's tougher to find. Hopefully it will be available later this year. ICC, International Code Council, requires us to have roughly 3 days of continuing education in our renewal cycle, which is a 4-year cycle. And they want us to have 16 hours a year now. So we'll be able to find that. Very confident. And we'll start that program. I think we can do that with the current year. The fire investigator certification, we've missed that opportunity for this year. We'll be looking at that for next year, and then annual training after that. That will help in several different ways. Currently, we've got 3 trained investigators, and the Sheriff's Department has 2. So we just have to have the certification now, go through that process. And the last item in that column would, well, this spans the 3 columns, increase fire prevention programs in the community. We're looking for ways to provide additional programs to the community, whether it's fire extinguisher classes, it's fire safety classes. We're in the schools in October. We're doing the open house. We're doing the fair event now. We're always looking for different opportunities to reach out and educate and touch the community, try and enhance fire safety throughout. In the past few years, we've upped our numbers in that, and we continue to do that. The third column, update with additional staff and increased budget. These are items that we probably won't be able to do without additional staff. Annual fire inspections, Our current contract asks for inspections every 4 years, each business every 4 years. We've got it down to every 2 years. We're in each business every 2 years. The higher occupancies and the schools we're in annually. But surveying rating would like to see it handled. It's doable, but we have some things we have to work through to do that. We'll have to have additional personnel, and we'll have to have some way to input from a handheld device into our current reporting system. Right now we're looking into that, and we found our current software program is Firehouse. It's a record-keeping device. We input everything into it. However, it's not as friendly with the inspector program. The inspector program will only do inspections and fire hydrants. We would like it to do pretty fire plans that are farther down on the list. And I'll get to that in just a minute.
Gary, just really quick, and this is something that you mentioned at the meeting too, since our contract requires 4, but you're doing it every 2 years. But because of that, you have drastically seen a drop in fires in residential and...
Well, not...
I mean, not residential, but commercial.
I don't know if I would say drastic, but we have seen a reduction in... We're not going into the overloaded circuits, electrical circuits, things like that now. We're seeing exits that are not blocked any longer. We've seen an improvement in our commercial ventures. And there, we're writing less violations. I don't think we've had to turn a violation over to the city for enforcement in the past 2 years, just because people want to remedy the violation, and they're relatively minor violations anymore. But we have seen a reduction in our commercial fires. Upgrade our hydrant testing inspection program includes more data input. Data input in fire hydrants takes more time than the actual testing of the fire hydrants. It's just tedious to put in all the flows, all the static residuals, the locations and everything. It takes time. So I'm looking for a handheld device so we can do it in the field as we're doing the testing. Hopefully that will speed up the process. That goes hand in hand with the inspections and the pre-fire planning device. We're trying to find a device that will do it all, so we don't have to have multiple software programs or devices. It just makes sense to all in one. And that will take some buy-in from a change in the program from Public Works, so which should be a reduction in their time, but it will be a change for them. Daily apparatus checks. Survey and rating would like to see us do daily apparatus checks, and that will be on all the engines. We have 7 engines. City has 4, the county's got 3. And we estimate 25 to 30 minutes per engine to do the complete check. You're checking all the fluids, you're checking all the gas tools, you're running them, you're doing a complete check of all the equipment on the truck, which seems like overkill to do it when some of our trucks haven't ran in the past several days. Why would you have to do it every day? They want to see documentation that it was done every day, 7 days a week. So there's some things that on here that we can look at doing, but truly it may be better to look at other options as well. That being one, you know, we do a post-run inspection now. If we have a incident we run out on, we do a post-run sheet on it where everything gets fueled and operational is checked, all the fluids are checked, all the devices are checked now, so. I guess I skipped increased number of volunteers. We're always looking for volunteers. That's an ongoing project. This year, we attracted 7 new volunteers. Great group of people, very willing to learn. They're sticking with it. We will lose one in August. He'll be going to college, but he's going to be here for our wildland season, so I'm happy with that. And knowing that we had a firefighter come back to this group that trained with us several years ago, went away to school, he came back to the community. So I'm very happy with that. Always looking for volunteers. Pre-fire planning, we would like to go out to each business, industrial, commercial, and churches and schools, every high occupancy, pre-fire plan. We go in, we identify fire protection systems, fire alarm systems, firewalls, exiting. We address where all the hazards are, the square footage, the fire flow, where the hydrants are, our access points, the entire thing, and we put into a program. This will benefit both our response and it will get us some points with surveying rating. So that is a huge payout right there. Again, it will take software compatible with what we're using to get us there. We are looking at that. The entire software package we're looking at for all these programs. So these are all things that we're looking into, trying to find that one that will work all the way through it. And then the next item. These are our items that, this one's a city issue, the generator for the city station. The city fire station has no backup power. It has well over $2 million worth of equipment in it right now. If we were to have a power failure, the doors would have to be operated by hand, which can be done. The lights would be out at night, which we've had in the past. We can mitigate some of those problems. The things we can't mitigate is if it was to happen in the wintertime when it's cold, drops below freezing in there, your building is protected by a fire sprinkler system that would be susceptible to freezing as well as the apparatus in there. Having a generator is a true benefit to everyone down there. And yes, there is county equipment in there. You know, when we open the doors, you'll see yellow equipment in there, you're going to see red equipment in there. But if you look in the other station, there's yellow and red in there too. The reason is if we had a failure of any one of those buildings or a fire, we have equipment that we can back up in the other building. It's not going to be a total loss. But we do need to protect that building. And Wade asked me at the workshop to provide some numbers for a generator there, and I did. And that will be something you'll address during your budget process, I'm assuming. When we put ours in, we put our generator in the main station, big enough to power the entire station, because we didn't want to have to separate things we were doing. We wanted, in the event of a disaster or a long power outage during the winter time, if people need to come get warm, they can come to the station. It's somewhere the public can come and shelter. Won't be the greatest place, but they'll be able to get warm. So we would like to see the city put a install a generator and power that station. The last column is more of a planning for the long-term future, city and county. These are joint items that we can work together on. Build a training facility that has to be 2 acres minimum, 3 stories to meet the criteria of surveying rating. It would have a burn room in it that firefighters attack a fire in. You can have some smoke rooms in it. It could be, if built right, correctly, it could be a joint where law enforcement could use it for their needs as well. So it could be an all-around building for everybody. But that's something to look at for the future. The closest training facility that is truly open to the public or other agencies is Hammer in the Tri-Cities. To take the number of firefighters we have down to Hammer would leave our community vulnerable, so we don't take our firefighters there. We bring the flashover trailer in. However, that's the only prop that we bring. So this would give us additional things that we cannot get in our community, as well as possibility of other agencies using it. And then the next one, at some point we will have to add larger crews of paid firefighters. Othello's grown. We know what's going on about 14th Avenue on the Highway 26 corridor, the foreground. Othello is growing. So we will be adding firefighters in the future. We will have to have a place to house them. So that's something we need to address and talk about. If you have any questions with some of these programs, I'd be more than happy to answer.
As you just said, with increasing the size of the city, and in not necessarily just the city, but the Adams County deal that's going, where you're putting in more hotels and more concentration of people, what does that do to your overall rating when you add things like that to what you have to deal with as a fire department when you only have three full-time employees?
It increases our exposures.
So,
and as it increases our exposures, it will increase our alarms, and we will see those increased alarms will draw more need for firefighters, and they'll look at that option.
So it potentially could raise your rating, which you don't want to do.
Well, right. It potentially could, but we need the growth. We're going to get the growth.
Yes.
So we need to, like I said, be proactive and start planning towards that. And
yeah,
and these programs are a step ahead.
It just strengthens the fact that it needs to happen.
Right. Because I would hate to see that increase in insurance costs in our community. As it was pointed out earlier, we have a lot of low income that would struggle to insure their homes, and it would be an impact on businesses in our community. I'm sure it would. Then the next item we talked about that evening was the Othello fleet of apparatus. This is a very brief overview of your fleet now. And the city established years ago a 30-year rotation on your suppression equipment. So every 30 years you're surplusing the oldest of the fleet. In 2012, the city bought the Chevy Tahoe for a command vehicle. Our fire inspector drives it as well. that setup, so we have a small command table in the back of it in the event of a large fire that we can set up and command from there. We've got some mapping capabilities on a grease board, different things like that, but we can operate out of the back of it. The next unit, 8121, excuse me, is a demo truck. It's a 2005 apparatus, 75-foot aerial. It is a pumper too, that is a Quint. And you picked that up in 2007 from Yakima, Cascade Fire down in Yakima. That $485,000 was a very good deal at that time because it was a demo. The engine is a, newest engine is a 2002 E1 Typhoon pumper, and it was also bought through a sister company out of Yakima to Cascade Fire. The next would be your quick response, which is still in service, and we're using it as a rescue, a backup rescue, with extrication equipment. Next engine down is a 93, which is an E1 pumper as well. Same company out of Yakima sold the city that. The oldest unit is a 1984 ladder truck, 75 foot. And it is experiencing some age problems, some rust in the plumbing and the tank. And some of that is going to be very, could be very expensive to maintain. That will have to be addressed in the future, but right now it still meets all its testing criteria and it still pumps to capacity. So it's still in active service. And we are getting a huge credit for that truck. So we need to keep that in service as long as we can, even after the 30 years. Keep that in service and we get ladder credits that most communities don't, since we do have two aerial devices. The costs were put on there so you have an idea of what it costs to purchase equipment, at least at the time you purchased it. I can tell you right now, a standard engine like the 8111, the third item there, is roughly $400,000. So in 2022, when you go to spec an engine for a renewal in 23, you'll be looking at over $500,000 for a new engine.
So and as it says there, that doesn't include the equipment for that engine.
Correct.
That's just the engine.
We recycle as much equipment as we can. And there's a point where you can't recycle, but with some of the programs, the hose programs, different things like that that we're doing, you know, we should be sitting a lot better by then with equipment. So equipment costs would be minimal.
Gary, could you let the council know really quick what the average cost is per firefighter to equip them with backpack, air pack, and gear and everything else?
The bunker gear alone, from head to toe, boots, pants, coat, hood, gloves, and helmet, is right at $3,000. The SCBA, we don't have a hard cost on, but it's going to be somewhere, it's SCBA, self-contained breathing apparatus, is somewhere around $4,000 right now. And you put a spare cylinder into that, you're looking at probably another $800. So you're pushing $8,000 to equip a firefighter. But that brings up the need for the city to set aside in the line item money annually to replace your fire apparatus. I think you've gotten away from that for the last few years. I encourage you to keep contributing to that line item. And estimate that $500,000 to $510,000 for a new rig in 2022.
I think we currently have about $190,000 in reserve right now. But
yeah, we have $190,000 in reserve right now. We've been putting away about $20,000 a year. Last year we didn't put anything away. Two or three years ago, I think we put $100,000 away, but typically it's been about $20,000. We were talking briefly about the generator at our last meeting, and so I wrote down generator on my little tickler file for building our next year's budget also. So when we come to that budget time, we'll have the generator on there. I think the cost that I was given was about $35,000.
I think it's just a little bit over that, 38.
Okay.
Maybe.
Okay. So I wrote that down, and then I also put a star next to keep on building this reserves up from 190,000. So we'll have all those things when we're building our budget.
And kind of in a summary, what I've touched on tonight is a plan that I would like to start addressing these programs and working towards the future, serving the public better, serving the community the best way possible. If you have any questions.
Council members have any further questions or comments for Gary? Gary, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
And thank the volunteers. I know what it takes, and that the demand is increasing on training, and like I said, they're volunteers, and they're on call 24/7. They're one of the greatest set of volunteers we have.
All right, thank you.
2015 financial statement. Spencer.
Yeah. Wade and the mayor and I were talking briefly about having just kind of a brief update on some of the things that we do every month when we're looking at our budget, just monitoring our budget every month, and a couple of emerging items that are interesting that we wanted to let you know about. Every month, Wade and I'm going to sit down here so I can work the machine here also. Every month, Wade and I are looking through different financial trends. I put up a sample of some of the stuff that we look through every month up here. We look through our general street, utility tax fund, water, sewer, garbage. We look on the revenue side and the expense side to look for anomalies, things that weren't expected. When we establish our budget for the year, we can't just plug that budget and just go with that. But a budget is a living thing. It's kind of, revenues are going to be up and down, and expenses will be up and down, and we've got to constantly monitor this thing to make sure we're on track for where we want to go. And as we see things that make it so we have more funds available, we want to bring that to your attention so we can add some more things to the budget if you want. And if things are getting tighter, we also want to let you know so we know where we've got to tighten our belt a little bit. So this first, we're going to talk through four different things. The first two, I think, we'll have a little more discussion, and then the last two are pretty quick FYIs. So this is the first one. This is a copy of the sheet that we look through when we're looking through general fund revenues. And you can see this has January, February, and March. We don't have any April in here. But when Wade and I are looking through here, we look at where are the revenues compared to the previous year at this time? Are we up, down, about the same? January is really close to last year. February, it looks like February's down from last year, although it looks like last year was a bit of an anomaly if you look at all the years across here. Then March, we're back up. In March of last year, we had some transfers that we did that we didn't do this year. If we take those transfers out, then then marches up. So anyway, so we're looking through our revenues and our expenses, and this is something that you can look through at your own time, and if you have questions, we can talk through those. I was just going to mention one thing with our utility tax revenues. Our utility tax fund is where we collect the utility taxes for water, or for telephone, electric, natural gas, and cable. And all the revenues that come into this fund are, they're general fund dollars, but what we do here at the city, we take roughly 50% of those utility tax revenues, and we bump those over to the general fund for the general fund purposes of the city. Then the remaining dollars are left there for capital purchases that are $25,000 or more. And so the utility tax fund is always of interest to Wade and I. And in January, February, and March, we're just down slightly. And you know, we want to share this with you because this means that we don't have all the dollars that we thought we would in the utility tax fund, and then in the general fund also, because half these revenues go into the general fund. But it's just slight. We want to make you aware of that, but we don't want you to panic yet, because we're just 3 months into the year. You know, there's so many different things that could happen. Wade and I were trying to think of different reasons for this, and one of the big drivers that we thought could contribute to this is just the mild winter that we had. It wasn't very cold, so our natural gas revenues are the tax from those are going to be down. So that's something that we watch in April and May, and we'll see what this looks like as we get further on into the year. There's one year, 2011, I believe. This is when we received that unexpected $900,000 about 4 years ago in natural gas revenues. And so when we have things that stick way out of the ordinary, I put some notes down here, and you can't read it up on the screen here, but maybe on your screens you can, and then folks at home can see those too. So that's something that Wade and I are always looking at and always interested in. The second thing that I wanted to share with you was just a brief review of the utility tax fund itself. When I meet with the finance committee, we've been talking about this fund and why do we have this fund. A lot of cities don't have a utility tax fund. Like I said just a second ago, these are general fund dollars. So these revenue, the natural gas, the electric, these different revenue line items are just part of the general fund. And they're just kept there. The revenue comes in there and the city uses them appropriate as we need to meet the needs of the city. So here in Othello, about 1991, when these taxes were established, the decision was made to not lump those in the general fund, but keep them in their own fund. And I think part of the reason for this was so we can have easier monitoring. Anyway, we'll talk about that here in just a sec. In our finance committee meetings, the question was raised, do we still need this fund? Every year when we establish the budget, we determine the dollars that we need from this fund, and we move those dollars over to the general fund, and we revisit the Othello Municipal Code that has a 50% stipulation, 50% of the revenues that come into our utility tax fund are automatically drawn over to our general fund. This year we had to do something different. It was 56.5%. The year before I think was 60%. And so we're wondering why are we creating this extra work for ourselves? As we came up with a couple different options, and this is just something for you to keep in the back of your minds for the next couple of months, kind of mull over a little bit. One, we can just keep it as it is and just keep on moving forward. One, we could totally get rid of the utility tax fund and bring those revenues directly into the general fund and expense them as we need those dollars. And then a third option would be to revisit the municipal code to soften up some of the language in there. So instead of having a hard and fast 50% of the revenues are moved to the general fund, have something like we transfer dollars over per the budget or as needed. That way we can still keep these revenues separate. It's a little bit easier to monitor what we're spending these dollars on, but at the same time we can budget as we need to for the city, and we don't have to revisit the municipal code every single year to allow us the 50%, 60%, 55%, whatever it happens to be for that year.
So wouldn't it be easier also just to kind of, like we do on some of our fund balances, have a minimum balance in there? You know, also if we want to keep it.
Yeah.
It would make it easier for you, wouldn't it?
We could do that. This is one of those funds, it's kind of it's a renewable fund. Every year we get about $1.2 million in revenues into this fund. But that's certainly something that we could do. So as we're going through the year, just kind of have this in the back of your minds. I put together a brief down below, a brief bullet point list of when this fund was created, and just kind of tells the story of the fund. How it's changed: 1992, 2001, 2004, 2014. So you can kind of look through there and see what you would like to do as a council. If you want to keep things as they are, or if we want to make some changes. And I have some brief language here that talks about the discussion that we just had. Two other things that I wanted to bring to your attention. Our REIT fund. This is our real estate excise tax fund. In this fund, we collect about $35,000 to $40,000 a year, and these are dollars that can be spent on streets, roads, sidewalks. There's an RCW that governs what these things can be spent on, and it's really, if it's in public works, more than likely these dollars can be spent on it. Water, sewer, the infrastructure, these different facilities, brand new facilities and rehabbing old facilities. So a bunch of different things there. Well, we receive in between $35,000 and $40,000 a year in this fund. And we get all of those dollars from the county. We get anywhere from $1,500 to $6,000 in a month. And it always comes from the county. In March, I received a check from the state, from the state treasurer's office, to the tune of $54,000 in REIT money. And I was totally surprised, because first of all, that's more than we expect to receive in the entire year. And it was from a source that we don't usually receive these dollars from. So on one hand, I thought, oh my gosh, that's great, it's another $54,000. I thought, well, what if they sent it to us in error? So I talked to the Department of Revenue, and they said, well, it had to do with a sale of Albertson's stock to Safeway, or vice versa. And I thought, oh no, we don't have Albertson's, we don't have Safeway. They made a mistake. This isn't ours. Well, I asked the question again, and it turns out it is our money. It has to do with the sale of interest in Columbia Coal Store and the water hole down on 17 here. So it's 52,000 and 2,000 roughly. And so those are our dollars that are unexpected, $54,000. So we'll get that on top. It's a one-time $54,000 that we'll get there. And we can add that to the $37,000 that we expected to receive in that fund for this year anyway. And so these are dollars that we can spend right away. We could wait and see what happens with our utility tax fund. As you saw, that some of those revenues were under a little bit, at least initially for the beginning part of the year. When we were budgeting for 2000, for this year, one of the things that the council wanted to do was put another bathroom up in Lions Park for $150,000. And so this is money that we can tap for that also. This is a third of that. But I would recommend that we just sit on it for now for a couple of months and see what's going to happen with some of those other funds to see if we need it somewhere else. And if not, this opens up some other opportunities for the city. So that is of interest. And then the very last item here is just our debt review. A few years ago, I presented the debts that we hold as a city. We have five different debts. Well, in 2014, we made the last payment on one of those debts. 2015, we'll make the final payment on another debt, City Hall refunding bonds. And in 2016, we'll make the final payment on our Well 7. So after this year and next year, we'll just have two long-term debts that we're paying on. Those will be $31,000. It changes slightly based on the year, but about $31,000 a year and $134,000 a year. This debt here is going to increase. Right now, we're just paying the interest alone. So that one's going to increase to about $244,000 a year. So next year when we're building the budget, this expense is going to drop off to $184,000. We'll gain another $110,000 here. So we'll have about another $70,000 or so is what that'll net to in utility tax dollars that we'll have to play with in the budget. So those are four very fast reviews of a couple of financial interest topics. Are there any questions or any of those things you want to talk a little more about? We can talk here. We can talk. My door is always open. Wade's door is always open. I meet with the finance committee, you know, on an as needed basis, and we talk about these things also. But as a council, I thought this debt review here is really cool to see. By the end of next year, we're going to be down to two debts, and the way it falls, we'll have another $70,000 of this here that we'll be able to use. We have the extra $54,000 in REIT money that we just got last month that we might be able to use for a new
generator.
Or new generator. Yep. Yep. So anyway, those are some items of interest for you tonight. If there are any questions, I can take those, but that's all I have for you. Is there any further questions or comments for Spencer? Thank you. Committee reports. Is there any committee reports for tonight? Any unfinished business? Any new business?
I just got a question on where do we stand on 14th Avenue rebuild?
We got, last week, we finally got from GNO the plans to do that. They're in review now. Is that right, Terry?
Yeah, they're in draft set.
So we'll get that done here in another couple of weeks and then go out to bid.
Okay. Any further business? Hearing no further business, meeting's adjourned.